Today's guest is world-famous video game designer Sandy Peterson. He's worked on games like Doom, Quake, the AOE franchise, Halo Wars, and countless others.
Let me tell you about this awesome secret. Originally, for a very brief moment, the mangonels could destroy stone and gold, too.
Really? That would be broken.
That went away fast.
Yeah, I was going to say, that would be broken.
Yeah, that was one game, and we said, okay, not going in.
Impressively, he also has his own board game company and is the creator of Call of Cthulhu, which I learned today is the most popular RPG in Japan.
Yeah, no, usually when someone says, I'm big in Japan, and what he's really trying to say is he's small everywhere else.
Yeah. But you can actually flex that with some authority.
Yeah, that game is genuinely big in Japan, so this
is the third time Sandy and I have talked. If you're interested in the older episodes, I'll leave a link down below, along with other episodes I think you might be interested in. We talked a lot about AOE, the AOE franchise, and his board game company in today's episode.
Welcome back to the pod, Sandy. Episode 3 between me and you. Always a fun time. I'm extremely happy you're here. You're in good health, I hope.
Yes. I hear I cough.
No worries. No worries. That's bad timing, I guess, for me.
It's a very, very mild. It's been a terrible, terrible blizzard here in Texas. It's almost 50 degrees.
Really? Again? That's a rare thing in Texas, no?
Yes, which is only 20 degrees higher than freezing. So for us, that's almost a typhoon, you know?
You must be struggling.
It actually snowed last week, briefly. We had maybe a quarter, half inch. So, of course, that actually locked down the entire state.
I was going to say, did the power grid go down again? I didn't hear any news on it.
No, it didn't.
Thank God.
No, it didn't go down. It was just a little, it was tiny. Our power grid has many flaws, but it is better. It doesn't go down as easy as California's.
That's good.
I'll just say that.
It should be better equipped after what happened a year ago, 2 years ago.
Yes. Well, that was a really bad blizzard then. That was several days long. They hit everything.
That was like a once or twice in a lifetime event, no?
No. It happens more often than that here. But
it doesn't really. Oh.
Oh, sure. It's like the third time it's happened since I've been here.
Well, if all else fails, you can come here to Spain.
Spain doesn't have blizzards?
Not in Valencia, not where I'm at. So if all else fails, you're more than welcome to here if it gets too cold in Texas.
Well, I'm going to be there in March.
Oh, really? For what?
For the Interracio Madrid.
Oh.
I'm guest of honor at a convention there. I actually emailed you about that and said, hey, maybe we can meet up there in person.
Did you really? I didn't see the email.
It was in one of our threads.
Okay, well, I'm going to circle back with you. I definitely would love to do that. That sounds awesome.
Interracio Madrid, you will see it. And I'm going to be there. My wife will be there. It's March 24th to 26th.
I'm definitely down for that. If I saw the email, I most certainly would have replied. But what are you doing there specifically? Are you talking about old games you worked on, board game stuff?
I just do what I'm told. I probably have give speeches and sign games and be on seminars.
That's awesome.
This is actually my third trip to Spain for a convention. Though the first one was so the first. Trip I had was kind of interesting because what happened is that I wasn't actually a guest of honor. What happened is that a week before the War Chiefs was about to come out, or a couple weeks, my producer came to me and he said, hey, Microsoft forgot that we have there's going to be a tech convention in Barcelona. And we forgot to assign someone to go and show off the War Chiefs.
Right.
Right. And so they said, if you will go, then they will give you a choice of either flying first class or taking your wife. And I said, no brainer, right? Take the wife.
Right, right.
And it's not, right?
I mean, there's no chance you can get out of that with a first class flight. Let's just say there is no There's no universe where you can. I would not have told her,
but I don't care. First, who be like? So I get to have a shrimp cocktail and sit in a slightly bigger seat.
Yeah,
she's right. So, and my wife speaks Spanish, right?
Oh, wow.
I know Barcelona is Catalan, but and people have told me, oh, they don't want you to speak Catalan there. I said, look, they're not idiots. They don't expect Americans to speak Catalan.
Right.
We are going to have that. But Spaniards maybe have to speak it. So we go to Barcelona. Well, actually, we didn't go to Barcelona. Then she said, okay, then the day before I was to leave, my producer came to me and said, so one of the accountants said Microsoft decided that was too generous, and so you don't get to have your wife go. And I said, this was voluntary, right, to go to Barcelona? He said, yeah, technically. I said, I'm not going. And in that case, because, right? And because, of course, the thing is, for me, going to a tech convention to show my game is going to be me sitting in a little windowless room all day long.
Right.
And right, and then going back to the hill at night. Right, where my wife can party and go around Barcelona and have fun. And of course, at that point, no one on the team would go either because they heard what Microsoft tried to do to me. So my producer, who was a good guy, grinned and he went back and said, okay, he's not going. And so then they had to go back and rebuy the tickets for me and my wife because they hadn't got them yet because they thought I was going to cave. And they cost them like an extra $3,000. And so then I went and I got to sit in the windowless little room, you know, all day long and then go, you know, have paella and stuff with my wife at night. But man, did they miscalculate? I guess the guy, the accountant thought that conventions were going to be like tech conventions going to be like this big fun time for me.
Right.
I really want to go. It's like, I guess he's never been to a convention, you know.
They thought they had more bargaining chips than they actually had.
Yeah. And they did not. So he was sad. And so then the second time I went, I was invited to Cordoba.
Cordoba.
And there I was a guest of honor. It was for my past games, mostly Call of Cthulhu. And that was quite a surprise because I go there and one of the days there I was supposed to go have a signing session it looked like a gymnasium, right? I mean, the whole thing, they had a big convention center. So I go to the place where the signing thing is about 5 minutes early, and there's this long line of people going out the door and down the hall. And I figure someone was there signing. I wasn't the only guest. I figure someone there was signing before me. He wasn't done yet. I go, well, I guess I can come back in half an hour. But they said, no, go on in. So I go in, and it turns out they were all waiting for me ahead of time. I spent the whole hour signing games frantically. I had to tell them that I wouldn't, that they couldn't take a picture with me because it would slow down the signing session. But then all the rest of the time at the convention, I was signing things and then I would take pictures. So I was always signing things. The Spaniards were desperate to have me sign their copies of their games, which I frankly kind of puzzled me. I guess I never valued signatures myself. So it always seems kind of odd when people want me to deface their game.
But doesn't it seem like a surreal moment that you made your own company, your own game, and then you're in a foreign country where you have fans waiting for a signature? Like, does that kind of feel surreal?
Yes, it was. And in 2019, just before everyone got shut down in the worldwide lockdown, I got to go to Japan, and one of my first game ever, actually, Call of Cthulhu, the role-playing game, I found out that it is the biggest role-playing game in Japan, bigger than Dungeons & Dragons, bigger than it's huge. And that most of the players now, even in America, Call of Cthulhu has a higher percentage of women than Dungeons and Dragons does. Okay. Because it's not all about, it's about mystery and fighting monsters. It's not about killing monsters, getting money, leveling up, like, which is very compelling to most guys and me included. Right. But Call of Cthulhu is more of less testosterone directed, more of a mystery horror game, which girls like horror too. Right. So in America, usually the percentage of female players is like 25% of Call of Cthulhu. Then it's like 5 or 10% for D&D, right? But it's still less than men because to play my game in English, there's the filter of they have to have played D&D first because that's how you learn about role playing. Well, in Japan, they didn't have that barrier, so to speak. So 70% of the players in Japan are women.
Wow, that's really
and
cool.
Not only sells well there, there's more copies of my game sold in Japan than the rest of the world combined. And it's not an obscure game elsewhere. I was amazed. So the average player of my game is a 18 to 35 year old Japanese woman. So I go there, and the company is really smart. What they did is they let anyone, it's an open game license, you know, kind of like D&D kind of got socked with recently, where anyone can do an adventure based on the system. And the publishers figure this makes there be more adventures, more people playing it. It inspires more brand loyalty. And so at the convention, there was these hundreds of people, 70% women, with like a little booth 3 feet across with their little scenario they'd written up with like usually one piece of art on the cover that looked like a manga. And then the rest was all Japanese. So I went around with my wife and they were introducing me and my interpreter. And I tried really hard to make my wife jealous, but I failed.
That's cool, though. I didn't know that it was so popular in Japan. I mean...
Yeah, no, usually when someone says, I'm big in Japan, what he's really trying to say is he's small everywhere else.
Yeah. But no, you can actually flex that with some authority.
Yeah, that game is genuinely big in Japan. So on the other hand, Age of Empires is not so big in Japan. I don't know. I guess they like the role-playing stuff more.
Hi, apologies for the interruption, but I promise it's a good one. If you're enjoying today's episode with Sandy and you're an RTS fan, there's a good chance you might enjoy some of these other episodes that I did. Episode 49 and 51 is with Lewis Castle, who is actually the creator of the first RTS game ever made, Dune, and then he went on to work with the Command & Conquer series. He also worked with Spielberg on a game called Boom Block, so a really awesome episode. I hope you check it out. Episode 35 and 41 is with Ed Del Castillo, who worked on Red Alert 1 and Balrams, which are both very popular RTS games. If you're feeling a bit more adventurous, episode 62 is with Steve Murphy. He is the DEA agent that was in Colombia when Pablo Escobar was captured. The show Narcos is based on his life. And one last one, I promise. Episode 52 is a personal favorite of mine. It's with Leonard Skinner, who is a man that sold everything and lives on a boat. A really interesting and insightful conversation. So links to everything down below.
Or more likely, they just like to play games based in... Japanese authorship, you know.
Sure. But Spain and Age of Empires is huge in Spain, right? I mean, for Spanish-speaking countries
as well. I believe it's in Spain, yes. Yeah, that's why I had to go to Barcelona and foil the bean counter, right? Yeah, well, I mean, the Spanish were like one of the cool... I mean, I added them in The Conquerors.
Right.
And then, of course, they're like literally the main sieve in Age of Empires 3 because... Right. Who colonized most of the New World? Right. The Spanish. The English were latecomers. You know, I mean, we had in 1620.
In terms of sales, it did really well in Spain. Like, what countries might people be surprised that Age of Empires sold really well in? Like, we always think of just the American market, but like Age of Empires is a world recognized
really well
game. Really well in Europe. In most big European
countries.
Well,
you remember my story about them wanting to make it popular in Korea. I thought that was hilarious.
Yeah, that was amazing, yeah.
That's like, seriously? What's wrong with you people?
Just pan around every country. Make every civilization, give them their own storyline. I don't know.
Well, that's kind of what they seem to be doing now when they're adding like Latvians and Burgundians. Every little country has a civ. So they can keep making civs forever, I guess.
It's a tough one. What do you think about it? Do you think like that's the right way to go about keeping the game alive, or do you have a better idea to keep the game alive or generate revenue? How do you keep it alive? I mean, obviously there's a loyal fan base, right? So what's the best way to please everyone in this
region? One thing I learned from Age of Empires is that RTS games get a loyal following that lasts for a long time. Okay. If you're a shooter fan, you go and get a shooter and 3 weeks later, it's in the bargain bin at the store. You know, shooter fans aren't, they might remember your old crappy shooter that you did like Quake or Doom, but they're on the new one, whatever it is.
Right? In terms of replayability, it's very short lived is what you're saying.
RTS fans, they stick with it. So I remember when we were working on Age of Empires 3, we got our royalty statement from Microsoft about Age of Empires 1, which we still got royalties on, right? Because that we did that when we weren't owned by them. And we were selling a little over 1,000 copies of Age of Empires 1 a month. As of Age of Empires 3, which was crazy.
What was that 10, 15 years after it came out?
It was an ancient game, and we're still selling 1,000 copies. And at that point, it's completely free money, right?
Yeah, I mean, of course.
We long feedback are not on Age of Empires 1, and people were still buying it because, you know, they loved it. So RTS games, you know, they stick in your head, I think. I think it might be because it takes so long to learn to be good at them. I mean, if you look at the Age of Empires YouTube channels and stuff, they go into really incredible detail on these things. And they figure out all my dark secrets about why things are the way they are.
Spirit of the law. And he brings out those Excel sheets and everything.
Spirit of the law is merciless, you know. I was watching one of the things recently where he talked about the changes in the, I think the British and I had to go in there and make confessions, you know, where he said, it seems that originally the longbows had a minimum range and they didn't later on. And so I told him why in the comments. I said, okay, here's the deal. The longbowmen had a minimum range to kind of nerf them a little bit. And then we had a battle, and in the battle, there was a kind of not a huge army of longbows, because it wouldn't have happened with that, but like a middling to small number of longbows, and they were attacked by some unit that was able to get in among them and target them individually. And of course, so the longbows were spending all the time backing up to try to get the minimum range.
Right.
And not shooting. And they just got massacred.
It's like a scorpion, but like an infantry. I mean, a scorpion, but an archer drawback, right? Scorpions have minimum range?
I don't remember.
Regardless, yeah, it's okay.
I think they do. I think that skirmishers have a minimum range too.
I see skirmishers, yeah.
Anyway, so they're being killed, and so two of the other designers, not the balanced designers, just like other designers, were on the losing end, and so they basically went on a strike, and they absolutely refused to play British anymore until we'd fixed that terrible flaw. So they essentially blackmailed me and the sheriff. So we went back in and we took out the minimum range and we stuck in some stealth nerfs into the longbowmen to try to make up for it. I think we upped their wood cost by 5 and we might have slowed down their movement. I forget what we did exactly.
Yeah.
But we tried to make up for it. But that's why, but literally it wasn't because of balance that they didn't have minimum range. It was because these guys were really whiny. So because the thing is, it's not all done in a vacuum. I have to work in this company. There's got to be politics.
Yeah, you know? Right. There's favoritism towards certain civs and play styles and all kinds of stuff, right?
Exactly. And we'd have guys say, I will never play the Grenadiers because they're terrible.
Right.
So, but we knew the Grenadiers were, well, this time I was able, we were able to get around it. He said, the Grenadiers are bad. I'll never use them again. So I said, okay, we'll fix it. So me and Sheriff went back to our office and we had Diet Cokes and talked about other things. Then we came out and said, okay, it's fixed. And then they were great. And then he was fine.
And the power of the placebo effect, I guess, right?
The problem is we couldn't do that with the longbows because they could tell if they had a minimum range or not.
Right. It's too obvious, right?
We couldn't tell what changes we'd made to the Grenadiers. I mean, because we didn't make any, but we could have done modifications. You know, we could have done things that would be harder to notice.
What do you think about, like, having to balance this game today with so many new civs? Like, it seems like it becomes almost an impossible task.
Well, to be fair, assuming that the game, that they care enough, they can certainly add a huge number of guys onto it they can just pile on manpower to test the method. And if they have a good testing system, which I assume they must have a decent one, then they should be able to do it. I mean, it was really, we just had our team of player. We could have 8-player games go in at the same time. Or actually we could have 2 8-player games going at the same time. And then me and the sheriff watching them or sometimes playing if there wasn't enough people. And we played it pretty intensely and took a long time, but I assume they have like 50 guys doing it, and maybe that will make up for anything. I'm not. Are the new civs balanced? What's the word?
Yeah, I mean, they have I think they're relatively balanced in terms of like win percentages on ladder. I mean, they have an infinite amount of analytics to go over, so it's just a matter of minor tweaks and then waiting it out, right? It's not overdoing it with anything. So I think
it's also true. Yeah. It's also true that if you make like numerical changes, like your changes are numbers in their stats instead of like big things, then it's easier to balance because you can just say, well, if I give the guy twice as many hit points, then he becomes 4 times as good in the battle. That's just how it
right.
works.
Right. Just simple math.
That's how it works, right? But if you're doing something like when I said the Huns didn't have to have houses, that's harder to balance.
That's a huge fundamental change in the play style.
It's a huge
and everything.
Fundamental change.
Right.
And so it takes a lot. And I don't, as far as I can tell, they haven't done very many of those huge fundamental changes. Probably why.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, you don't want to mess up a good thing. Is there anything? I guess
also,
that brings
they
me
may not have,
yeah.
They may not have a programming staff who they may just be using the database to make their changes. They may not have a programming staff who's allowed to go in there and mess with the engine because it might introduce bugs.
Sure. Going back to the, I guess, the original question, keeping the game alive and continuously adding new expansions.
Keeping the game alive, yes. Okay. Well, my experience with my game Cthulhu Wars is that the number one thing people love is new factions. Because once you get a new faction, you get to go into the game again and play it all over with new eyes. New maps aren't as big a deal. New campaigns are, they're nothing on an RTS, right? So what people want is new factions. So yeah, I think new factions will inspire people who are thinking about dropping off a reason to go, well, I gotta try the Danish, you know? I don't even know if that's a civ now, but I wouldn't be surprised if it is.
I don't think it is. But hey, if they're listening now, if someone from the team is listening, you better pay Sandy.
Yeah, sure. You know, I got to try the Uzbeks or whatever it is.
Right.
And so it brings them back into the game to try it out. And then if it's fun, which hopefully you've made it fun, then presto, you've got people that are fans. And so, yeah, new factions is, in my experience, the way to make people the most interested in retrying the game in a game like Age of Empires. Like in a shooter, you don't have that option. You can get a new gun or something, but it's not really the same as a new faction.
It's not, right.
New faction, everything about your game is different with a new faction, you know?
Another thing to keep in mind is content as well, right? You want also people to have fresh content as for YouTubers, streamers. Like, that's another element that you didn't have to think about when you were creating games, right?
Because the streamers then get to have fun doing
new campaigns or trying out new civs.
Here's how to play the Uzbek, you know? Here's how to play the Eskimos. Whatever they're trying to do. And then they have that. And that re-inspires other people to try it. It's this way that if they look and they see the video, because they're still subscribed to the channel, even though they're off playing some other game now. They go, there's a new video here. Uzbeks, I got to see that. So they click on it, and he says, the Uzbeks are really cool in this age. Right? Whatever it says. I mean, there's not Uzbeks, I hope, but or I expect. But then that might – so, you know, I think that adding factions – if they want to keep the game going forever, adding factions is the correct way to do it. I'm not saying that's better than doing a whole new game.
I mean, right, look at a game like Magic the Gathering, right, where they add, similar mechanics all the time.
Yes, but Magic the Gathering, of course, when you add a new deck of cards, what happens is that people then, they make their own faction, in a sense that they have to, okay, I got to try out this whole new faction that uses these new cards, and often what Magic the Gathering will do is in a new, when a new edition comes up, they'll add some new... game some new
mechanic
feature. Like
yeah
now there's cards that have now there's plague type
right
cards or whatever,
right
they have. Now they have shards, and so I gotta see how I can make a shard deck, so everyone's having fun building their shard deck.
Well, Magic's at a place where it's been around, they can bring back old mechanics that are like forgotten, and they can say, oh, this is an old mechanic from 30 years ago, we've reinvented it a little bit, or
we took it out because everyone hated it, but now we're gonna love it because you've forgotten how bad it was.
Like for
my game Cthulhu Wars, we getting out new civs was always the huge thing, you know. So we do other things that I think, because really a new map is as big a difference as a new civ, I think, but people don't perceive it that way, which is, so I guess maybe I'm wrong and they're right because they should know, right? But
I guess we didn't talk about board games. I want to talk about board games as well. That's something we didn't do a lot of. How many board games have you worked on?
You gotta remember that my whole life right now is publishing board games.
I know, that's why I want to talk to you about it, because that's something you're really passionate about. That's why I love board games as well, but I don't know much about like the design process and what it, I mean, I imagine it's a nightmare to be working on like 50 more board games.
Well, my design process is probably pretty different from most board game designers, because I actually use the tricks I learned in balancing Age of Empires. So I use video game and computer game techniques in designing and balancing my board games, which makes sense. Yeah.
That's pretty cool. I mean, how does that translate in terms of balancing mostly
The way Ensemble Studios did our games, okay, was And it wasn't the same as every other company does. Most companies don't. But what we did is very early on in the process, we tried to get a version of the game up and running, no matter how crude. So it was already there, already playable, really early on, like 6 months in, 4 months in, we had a version that was running. Okay. And then we would start playing it. And we'd play it, and then we'd play it, and then I would go back in my office and make changes or talk to the programmers. We'd play it again. I'd go back in my office, make changes, or tell the if it's a change I can make in the database, I would do it. But usually the programmers had to do it, or an artist had to draw a new unit and put it in, you know. And then we'd keep doing that. So we're playing this game every day, often multiple times a day, making multiple changes every time there's a test. And the result is it probably took longer to do the game because we didn't start with a vision in mind necessarily and go up to the vision is correct, then do the game. We have an almost finished game and then we start testing it. Because we're testing it. I remember me and Greg Street were once sitting in a seminar. They were talking about a RTS game, which I won't, which was a good RTS game that still sells, but I won't mention which
StarCraft,
one.
StarCraft, Red Alert.
I'm not going to say, okay, but it was one of those.
Okay.
Okay. And the guy up there was saying, you have to play test your game a lot. And me and Greg are like, yeah, you have to play this a lot. He said, you have to play this so much. And we said, yeah, you have to play this more than you ever thought you could play test it. And we said, yeah. And then he said, we play tested our latest game for 3 whole months. And Greg and I burst into laughter because at that point, we've been play testing Age 3 for 18 months.
Jeez, wow.
And we weren't done yet. So 3 months was like ludicrous.
Right.
You know? Now, one of the things this got us at Ensemble Studios is that we knew the game was fun early on because we were making sure it was. In fact, Age of Empires 3 took like a year before it was fun to play, and it was really worrying us that we couldn't make it fun. I mean, it was okay, but it wasn't fun like Age 2 and Age 1. We finally got to the point where it was fun, and then we can go into other iterations, right? But the thing is, because we've been playing the game for a year, we knew it was fun, and we could prove it was fun because people were playing it in their off hours. People would cop into our office with exciting suggestions. We just knew it was fun. When I was working at MicroProse Software, we could tell when a game was fun or not because if it wasn't fun, the playtesters were done when they're done with the day. Or maybe it could be fun still, but they were like sick of it, right?
Right. There's levels to that, right? There's levels to that,
right?
Fun.
But when they were testing Civilization, the first Civilization, those guys were playing it on their lunch hour and they'd stay late and they just went crazy about it. So we knew Civilization was onto something. So Ensemble Studios always knew our game was going to be fun before it was released. And as a result, all of our games were fun. We never had a clinker.
Do you have that same feeling with board games? Do you have that sense when you know a board game is going to be a hit?
Yes.
Really?
Because what I do is just like Ensemble Studios, I start testing the game really, really early. And keep going through iterations so I can see the players playing and having fun. And even when it's not fully balanced, doesn't have all the features in, they're having fun, so I know I've got that core part of the game. And if I add a feature that makes it not fun, it goes. You know, I can give you an example. So in a recent game of mine coming up is actually the next game we're going to get out in physical form. It's called Hyperspace. And it's a do you know what a 4X game is?
Yeah. Like a really complicated, in-depth game.
Well, sort of. I mean, it's exploration, exploitation. I forget what the third X is, but the last is extermination.
Yeah.
Expansion and extermination. So you're trying to build... Civilization is kind of one, right? Okay. So Hyperspace is one, and... But it's not a. But usually they're the games that take like 10 hours to play. Well, Hyperspace you play in 2 hours, but it has all the features. So in Hyperspace,
it's a board game. Sorry, it's a board game.
It's totally a board game. Okay. It's totally a board game. 4X games can be board games or.
Okay, I didn't know that. Okay, cool.
Yeah. So I'm working. So early on, I had this idea to have a market in space. Okay, and the way it was going to work is, I thought it was pretty clever. Is that when you bought a good that you pay credits to buy steel, you know, metal or radioactive or something, then the price of that good would go up.
Just like in Age of Empires, like a market. Yeah.
Yeah. And if you sold it, the price would go down. Okay. So there'd be, and then I had civilizations that messed with the market and did different things. They had abilities that bypassed them, right?
But this is you doing it manually on a board game level, so there's no like computer programming.
That was a graph.
Okay.
Markers
are going
down.
I got you.
You know, it was pretty simple to do, right? It wasn't as detailed as a computer game because it's a board game, but you can see what was happening and say, well, I'm going to sell 10 metals, and then you go, okay, metal price now went from 2 to 3. You know, and then say, okay, now I'm going to buy – sorry, if you sold them, the price would go down. If you bought them, right? So we had the system, and it was in there, and it was working, you know, and it worked just the way I wanted it to. And one day the players came into play, and it was gone. And they said, what happened to the market? And I said, I really loved the market, and I took it out because I want this game to be about exploring planets and being aliens and blowing up spaceships and not economic markets. And there was too much time spent looking at the market. And people would forget to do the market thing all the time. They'd buy something and forget to adjust the track. So on a computer game, you never forget.
There's that expression, like, you got to kill what you love in a sense if it's damaging to the overall product, right? And that's can be very difficult.
Exactly. And so I still have that idea in the back of my head that there may be a game coming up where the market will work and be fun. So I still have that concept. And that's one of the ways I kill my kids is that I'll say, you know, my game kids, is I'll say, okay, this will be used somewhere. And I'll wait, and then sometime later it'll get used, you know. So I had to take that out. And it made the game more fun. And there's other things I took out too, here and there that I added. But even when they weren't fun, the way they modified the game often ended up with a stronger game in the future. So,
how do you juggle all these things? Is my question. There's so much I think going on.
I've been doing it for 40 years, right? So the basic human principle is if you do something for a long time, you get better at it. The thing that makes a good game designer, in my opinion, is obviously first that you are creative. You have to have, right? That goes without, right? And my creativity is more syncretic than some designers. Like, I used to work with a guy called Greg Stafford, and he would just pluck things out of the void. He'd say, out of the blue, says, okay, we can have this cool idea. And it was just genius. But my job was always to take his ideas and turn them into something that would work.
Functional. Make him functional.
Game. So my idea of a new thing, I would sometimes get new ideas from nowhere, but usually what I do is I'll have two disparate ideas and said, oh, what if these things would work like this? And I'll take ideas from other sources and put them in, you know. But it's still creative. It's just a different kind of creativity. Anyway, so creativity is the number one thing you have to have a game designer. Number two thing you have to have is you have to be absolutely obsessed with games. And so I'm that. Largely the way I perceive the world is in terms of games. Like I'll see people building a structure and I'll think about how that could be a game of putting in a level, right? And everything is game stuff.
Interesting.
Me, right?
Everything is gamified.
The third thing you have to do is be able to make deadlines. And that's something that they often forget about. You have to be able to actually be in a schedule. You can miss a deadline by a little bit if you're doing something really important. But you ultimately have to, well, maybe deadline is the wrong way of putting it. You have to be able to deliver, because I know people, and you know those games that some crazy guy is doing in his garage that people hear about again and again, Battlefield 3000, that goes on and on and takes years and years. He's never quite done with it. See, those guys have failed in the third aspect of being a game designer, is you have to get that game out there.
Is that someone that's just afraid to release their imperfection? Is that someone that's a perfectionist to the extreme?
I think that's it. I think they just like, and at some point, the way I could tell when my game was ready to go out is if I played it for a couple of rounds, for a few tests, and I found myself either not making changes or noticing that the changes were just going back and forth. You know?
Yeah.
That they were little. I said, yeah, you know what? This is done. And so all the games go out with it. Like, I could have done something even better, but that's okay too, because it means I'm excited for the next game. But
that's the battle of being a creative, isn't it? The battle of being a creative is constantly releasing stuff imperfect and accepting that it's going to be always better in your head after it comes out, right? That's the thing I always struggle with as well. It's like, I want something to be perfect, but then I don't want to hold on to it forever, right?
It's tempered with the joy that every once in a while it turns out to either be the way you thought or better. So, for example, on the War Chiefs, I'm trying to do the Indians. And boy, it was a fight to get to do the Indians, because everyone wanted us to do Asia. I'm not saying Asia was bad, but my argument was that like Asia didn't colonize the New World. So as interesting as Koreans and Japanese and Khmers were, like we didn't have them in America, right? And we did have Native Americans, and they were really interesting, you know. So the first civ I did was the Iroquois, because they were the most like a European civ. You know, they had muskets and they were more, right. And so I was working on it, but I wanted them to still feel different and natively American. So we did that one first, and I was really hoping people would like it. And after the very first playtest, and they weren't balanced at all yet, right? They were just stubs of the final Iroquois. They came back to me singing its praises. Those guys are so fun. And so I had to ask them, okay, what made them fun? And the first thing they said was, because you get a whole bunch of little crappy siege weapons.
That's it?
Right, that you can just send them and blow up. That's super fun, right?
Sure. Unexpected.
And so when I did the next one I did was I think the Aztecs, and the third was the Sioux. And they loved those too. You know, now in the case of the Aztecs and the Sioux, I think it also helped that they were visually spectacular.
Sure.
But you know, I was so happy that they loved the war chiefs, and that really they loved the Aztecs and Sioux too. Maybe not quite as much as the Iroquois, but they loved them. And so that was huge for me because it worked how I'd hoped it would be. Now, maybe not in terms of the civ being as perfect as I wanted it to be, but in the terms of the people's reaction to it, they loved it. And so that, and the whole company was won over to my vision of the war chiefs after playing the Iroquois.
I guess that's something we didn't talk about. That we the audience, that's the final P. Maybe you're missing that in your 3 points. Like, you're missing the audience feedback. Like, without that, creativity means nothing, right? I mean you could technically put it out there, but if no one's
usually after you're finished, right?
Right, that's way low in the process.
But it's super important to me. Obviously, one of the things is all game designers are huge, massive egocentrics, and so I try to mask that by making fun of myself. And pretending to be humble, but secretly I'm a giant egocentric too.
Right.
And so whenever I get a favorable review of my games, I gloat and read it and reread it. Whenever I get a negative review, I'm like, oh, those guys hate me. I'm so upset, you know. So, but the War Chiefs pretty much had solid reviews, and actually, Cthulhu Wars had when it first came out, it had one bad review, but it was a great bad review to have because it was a guy who hadn't played it and hadn't seen it.
Oh,
and
those guys.
His objection to it was first that it was based on Lovecraft and there was too many Lovecraft games, which is objectively true. But since I'm the very first guy to do a Lovecraft game, I thought maybe I should get a pass on doing one.
Right.
You know, I'm not piggybacking on the other Lovecraft games. It's me. I'm the original, you know. And the other complaint was that it was too expensive, and which it was. It's a $200 board game. Right. But there's not a lot of stuff in it. If you've seen pictures of it, it's like 72 of these giant figures and all this stuff. And so my argument about it being too expensive was that, you know, he was like, I could buy 4 other games for the cost of this one. I said, yeah, you could, you know, just like, but when you eat dinner at a nice steakhouse, do you complain that you could have had 8 meals of McDonald's for the same price?
Yeah. If you're
driving in a Cadillac, are you complaining that you could have got a Yugo? You know, not every game should be a $200 behemoth, and not all my games are that. But it's okay for a gamer to have one game on his shelf, which is a luxury game, I figure. And if they are going to, why not mine?
Okay, here's another board game question for you. Are people coming to you now with ideas for board games, and you're funding them? Or
yes, they're constantly trying to get me to publish them. Yeah, but I'm not really in a position to do that now. In fact, here, let me tell you my tale of woe and sadness.
Please. I was way too happy with my reaction. I meant, please. That sounds awful.
So the board game, it's okay. So modern board games are 95% of them are made in China. Okay. China has the plastic injection molds. Basically, to make a modern board game, what you need is high-tech equipment and cheap labor. Because there's a really boring ass part of it where you are literally just like gluing figures together or something, and it's not skilled labor, so you don't want to pay someone $50 an hour to do it, right? And they don't have machines that can do it, so you have cheap labor. So that means we can't, for example, do them in the Philippines, because while they have cheap labor, they don't have high tech. You know, we can't do it in Taiwan because they have high tech, but they have expensive labor, right? And we could, in theory, do it in India or Singapore because they have the combination, but they haven't yet started to do board games there. So we don't have the, I hope someday they do, because I like to not always have to do everything in China. But at the moment, if you want, right? So what happened is that when the crackdowns came for the dread, the white death that has covered the world, right? It happened just after Chinese New Year started. So Chinese New Year, what happens is that in China, because it's a totalitarian dictatorship, everyone has vacations when the emperor tells them to have it.
I mean, they have three vacation days a year. I've been there. They've told me they have literally three vacation days a year.
Well, it's more than that because it's like 2 weeks or more.
Oh, really?
when they get off for Chinese New Year. Yeah, they have a week for the Moon Festival in the fall too. So what happens is that everyone for the Chinese New Year, they all go home to their home province, which is not in Guangdong, right? No one lives, right? I mean, obviously people do live in Guangdong, but they all go home to their home province, okay? And then when the Chinese New Year is over, they come back to Guangdong, but because they're cheap on skilled labor, they don't necessarily get a job in the same factory they were in before. They just go to any factory and sign up. So you have to like retrain new staff every year. So it's like a month to 6 weeks where not much is being done in China. So all of our planning for our games are based around that. But this is beside the point, because what happens is everyone goes home to the home province, then China locks down the whole country for a year. So that meant that we could not produce any of our games. So all we could do was sell off the games we'd already produced for that year. So we kept all of our staff on staff, and no one was fired. Well, no one was worthy. No one was laid off, I should say, because no one would be fired anyway, right? So we kept them on, and we kept selling our stuff and doing new games. And then finally, when the COVID let up, we'd run out of stock. We had nothing left to sell, but we'd still been paying all our personnel because, you know, we were doing stuff. And then we realized that we were, our cash funds were at the point where I was going to have to go and like sell all my rental properties, which I did to keep the company going until we could get a cash infusion from an investor. So we could then do our committed projects on crowdfunding and keep the company going. And we had investors on the line, and they were from Poland, actually. And then we had them all ready to go, and just as they were about to give us an infusion of millions of dollars of cash, well, 2 million, that's millions, right? And that was going to essentially put the company on its feet, let us pay off all our, okay? Just 1 week before they're going to invest, Putin invaded Ukraine. And the Polish investors backed out, citing uncertainty of what's going to happen to Poland in the future.
Wow.
So then we started looking for other investors, but we kind of went down a rabbit hole. And then finally in July, I said to the team, I said, I thought we were going to be able to make it, and we're not. We're done. We're out of, we're flat out broke, you know? And so I was forced to let them all go.
Sorry to interrupt you. Question. Is China still in lockdown and you still cannot?
No. China went back in.
Oh, they went back in.
Start doing, we didn't have money.
I understand now. Okay. I got you. Okay.
Right.
Sorry. Carry on.
We run out during the lockdown. And then I spent money to keep going to get something started. And then we actually got one of the games going, Cthulhu Wars, which it just now got released. Although it's being delayed in America because of the Chinese New Year. Again. Right.
Wow. Which is awesome.
And occasionally there's little spurts, like where they're about to ship from the port, and then the port had a COVID scare, so it got locked down briefly. And they couldn't ship for a while, right?
Man.
So the occasional little
seems like
little
a nightmare that, to run right? this business in this current climate,
right? I know, right? So what happened? So I laid off everyone except for three of us, and I actually had to lay off my own son, which that was tough. But I kept one son because he was like, not because he was my son, but because he was like the business manager and he was critical in what we're going to do going forward. And he had to camp with the plan. He said, here's what we're planning to be. We have these commitments we have to do that are based on crowdfunding commitments. We're going to do one at a time. And when each one goes up, that will fund the next one. And we'll keep going down them in a serial order until they're all fulfilled. So we just did the first one. We're going on to the second one, and everything's going. And the thing is, because we kept everyone on staff throughout COVID, we actually had 15 games and game products fully designed and laid out and ready to go, but they just weren't printed because we didn't have money to print them. So we could actually survive for quite a while just putting out these old games. Not old now. They aren't old to the market, but the games we had already done. And so presumably by the time we run out of these, we'll have gotten enough cash. We'll be back on our feet. I'll have a whole staff again. Hopefully we can rehire the guys I laid off, the ones that want to come back to work for me, that is. You know, maybe not, they all won't. And then we'll be back on our feet. So we're actually in the process of clawing our way back out of the hole, but it was pretty traumatic for a while there.
Yeah, I'm sorry to hear that. But you've made so many games, you've had so much success, you could probably retire into the sunset and sell everything and never think about this.
I almost did last July, but my son talked me out of it. He said, no, we got to fulfill the commitments we made. And I said, okay.
Is it also for the love of building these games and working with these people and still staying in the industry?
I do love building games, but I could just decide to spend my time retired, annoying my wife, chasing around the grandkids, you know, playing games. But I do really like doing them, designing them. So, I mean, I'm 67, so I could retire in theory, I guess. But I did spend, except for the fact that I spent all my retirement money trying to fund the company through to get these next few things out. But if I can get these things out, then even if I end up penniless, I will have fulfilled my obligations, and that will be good.
I mean, that's very noble, right? I mean, good for you. Yeah, I didn't know that. That's unfortunate. It seems to run a business in this time, especially one as tough as board game publishing and creating board games. I mean, that seems like a nightmare.
And of course, there's been a lot of hostility because I haven't been fulfilling my obligations. But I'm like, but we tell them, here's the deal: we can do one game at a time, and we did the biggest one, and that one's done. So now we're going to do the next oldest one, and hopefully that will. And the thing is that each of these games we do, because they're based on Kickstarter products, what happens is that the money that we got from Kickstarter is long ago spent on keeping my company going during COVID, right? So that money is gone. If we held on to it and not spent it, then we'd just be broke now anyway. So, you know, what we're doing is that, so we're doing, like we're doing a hyperspace. Well, we have 4,000 copies of the game that we have to send to the backers, for which we get no return from now because they already paid us, but we owe it to them. So we got to make sure they get it. And then we have to do enough extra copies of the game to turn a profit to people that will buy it.
I understand. Are you looking for more ways to generate income as well, I assume, or to generate funds for
and
the...
to generate income, right. So we can use that income to pay off the factory, you know, the thing. Like, so here's the thing. So typically our games are about, the suggested price is about five times what it costs to manufacture it. Okay. So a $100 game on the store shelves is costs us $20 to manufacture. So we sell it to the distributors for $40. Okay. So we're making about a 50% profit per game. Then the distributors sell it to their stores for 60% of retail. And then the stores sell it, well, anywhere. Well, they usually discount it. So that's usually not 100%, but they can, whatever, you know, they get the biggest chunk of income.
Right, right.
But what happens is that, but here's the thing, see, so if I'm doing a game if I have to do 4,000 copies of the game for which I don't get reimbursed, because that's to the backers. Like I said, I mean, I was reimbursed. I'm not complaining, right? And then I do another 4,000 to sale. Then what happens is I make zero money, because the extra money I get from that second 4,000 basically pays for the whole print run and no profit. So I break even,
which
breaking even isn't necessarily bad, because it does mean that I met my obligation plus didn't lose money. But it's better if I can sell more.
I mean, you put an insane amount of time to break even is not the objective, right? It's to be profitable.
Yeah, it's to be able to go on and do our next game. So our factory in China, actually, the owner is in is not in China. She is in Colorado. She's been super, super helpful with us. So she's a princess, you know, and I mean, not a princess in terms of personality and beauty, not in terms of
just as a good human help for what she's done for the cause.
Yeah. And yeah, well, like, she carried us for Cthulhu Wars. She said, "I will print Cthulhu Wars, and all you have to do is pay me back once it's published." So wow, we're in the process
that's
of doing
rare
it.
In these times for someone to take that kind of deal.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, she trusts us. We've been with her for a long time. So our next game is Hyperspace, and that's our next game for two reasons. One is that it's the next oldest game that we haven't done that we've promised, but also because we think it's going to be a really big hit. It's super fun, and that's important. So I think it will, the reviews back when we made 40 copies of it back in the day when we were first working on the project to have people try and play it. And it just got rave reviews.
That's beautiful. I hope it succeeds.
So, they're like, it's a 4X game. I can play in 2 hours. It's great. You know, and the civs feel better. So you can actually currently play it online on Tabletop Simulator. So
cool. Is there like a place I can send people to, a link or something? Maybe include in the video.
Tabletop Simulator, they just have to look up the you know what, the best place to do it, go on Discord and join the Peterson Games Discord and ask about Hyperspace, and they'll send you to the Hyperspace channel. There's a group right now that plays it constantly on
cool. I'll add a link in the videos and whatnot. Yeah,
we're all excited to get a real one. You know, they all want the real.
Can I ask you another question? Can I ask you what you're playing nowadays and what you're watching and playing, I guess?
Okay, so the computer games I'm playing?
Yeah.
Well, last night for the first time I loaded up Magic Spell Singers, which is apparently a Magic the Gathering kind of thing, and to see if it was any good. And I gotta say, it had a lot of padding around the actual gameplay section. When I haven't managed to get through all the padding yet, they're making really sure I know how to play the game, so I'm not just thrown in there without doing things.
But you play Magic the Gathering in person with like real cards in the past, or no?
Not nowadays, but I used to.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah. It's way more fun with people. It's so hard to recreate
exactly,
that experience in virtual.
And I've also played another Steam game, Dinkum, which kind of took the opposite approach, kind of threw me into the world without telling me how to do anything. So I said, go bury a seed. And I said, how do I bury a seed? And then I didn't have any instructions, you know, and I had to work it all out. So that was the opposite end. But really, always the games I play the most often are the games that my son's always trying to get me to play Age of Empires with him and my granddaughter. But my skills are so weak now in Age of Empires that my son always beats me.
We want more AOE content. I mean, you could play games cool, but like the people want more AOE content. If you're looking for another income stream, I guarantee you, if you just started an AOE channel and just made, videos about the latest and greatest AOE stuff.
You want me to go head to head with people like Spirit of the Law and the guy that does the Age Tunes?
I believe in the product. I believe in Sandy. I believe that people want to hear what you have to say.
Let me give you a super awesome victory technique that my granddaughter used. Okay. So my granddaughter is playing with me and my son and my other son, okay? And my son, her dad, gets a small group of cavalry and goes into her... My granddaughter's 12. Okay,
so context, good.
And he goes into her town and starts killing villagers, like you do, right? And so her technique was perfect. What she did is she started to cry, and then... her mom came in and lectured Arthur and said that he had to stop picking on her. And then she was a good one.
So she won.
So that may not work for you.
I'll try to tell Doubt maybe if I've sent him a message. Doubt, have you tried crying in the tournaments? Maybe maybe someone just feels bad and they resign. Another thing I'm wondering is, have you been watching any video game-based shows or movies? That's been really fascinating to me over the past couple of years. Some of the budgets and actors, like, I don't know if you've seen Last of Us. I don't know if you've ever played Last of Us.
I have not played Last of Us, but it looks really interesting. And Critical Drinker has almost talked me into watching it.
I think it's pretty, I mean, it's not, I think the video game story and obviously the pacing, I like the video game more, but
the story is good too.
It's really good. It's so well made. And I just think like, man, I wish like, in your day, Netflix was throwing money at developers, and I don't know, what kind of... Do you have any ideas about making a potential movie adaptation of any of the games you worked on?
Well, for a while, there were some guys that wanted to make a movie adaptation of the Grant the RuneQuest game, and of course, Doom got made. The Doom movie.
When did that come out?
When it came out, I was too bitter to go see it. Then now I don't want to see it because I haven't. I've heard it's not so great.
Plus, 2005. Apparently,
my son told me about the zombies, and it's like to me, Doom is like the zombies are. You're done with them in like the first level. Then it's all demon stuff. But I guess demons are expensive and zombies are cheap.
The Rock was in it. Wow, I didn't even. To be honest, I didn't even know there was a movie. The Rock was in
it. So that kind of tempted me to go see it because you know The Rock, but.
But those are the old days. The old days are like they make really crappy movie adaptations because I don't know, someone behind it is very passionless about the project. Whereas like nowadays, if you see like the League of Legends one, Arcane, I believe, or I forget, I think that's what it's called, it's so well made and so polished that you can tell there's someone behind it that really cares. Cuphead, there's a Netflix Cuphead show.
Oh, for Cuphead kids. Is great. Yeah, watch my grandson playing that. So I mean like. I mean, my idea of a video game movie is something like Existence by David Cronenberg. You know, mm-hmm.
I've never heard of it.
You know who David Cronenberg is?
Sounds familiar. Let me quick Google.
He makes super creepy horror movies, and one of them is about a video game. So of course it's virtual reality because that's what Hollywood guys think are the cool thing. Anyway, Existence is a really weird. Exist ENZ.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm looking at this movie. Not discography. I'm looking at the movies he's made. I've never heard of any of these, but
I guess you're not a horror movie guy.
I guess
guy.
I'm not a horror movie guy. Yeah, I thought at least one of these I've seen.
He's a horror. He's definitely a horror movie guy. His movies are cerebral and full of body horror and creepy.
Yeah, I mean, that's an easy genre to make a video game adaptation on because there's so much to work with, right? I don't know what games that you worked on that would be easy to make. Not easy, but let's say exciting. You can't make a movie adaptation on Age of Empires, right?
The Last of the Mohicans was Age of Empires 3, right? But it really wasn't.
yeah. I don't know, man. I was really.
Yeah. So one of the things is, there's a novel on Cthulhu Wars. It's called In the Belly of the Beast, and it's available print on demand, and I think also on Kindle from Amazon. But if you look for In the Belly of the Beast, you'll get books that aren't it. But you have to look for the Cthulhu Wars one.
Yeah, I'm trying to find it.
Yeah, In the Belly of the Beast and Other Tales of Cthulhu Wars, and then it's 350 pages, and it's about Cthulhu Wars. Another good example of a video game movie, in a sense, I don't know if you ever watched any of the Gamera movies, the giant turtle that blows fire and is like a kaiju.
He's like no, Godzilla. No, I've not heard of those.
So in the 90s, there was the three greatest giant monster movies ever made, which were the three Gamera movies that were made then, which is weird because Gamera was like a competing line to Godzilla. Godzilla was the big one ever heard about, but there was also Gamera, more for kids. So Gamera made these really good movies in the 90s about Gamera. And the third one, Gamera versus Iris, was super awesome because one of the main villains was an evil game designer. So that was
sounds like a fun story. Make yourself a villain.
I like that a lot. And so Gamera versus Iris, you can go see it and it has an evil game designer. And so that's cool. He's not the only villain, but the fact that he's there at all is really good.
Did you know that? sorry to interrupt you. Did you know that Spielberg created a game, video game? Boom Blocks.
I did not. But my question, what's it called?
Boom Blocks. So I talked to a guy that created worked along with Spielberg. It's called Boom Blocks. It's on the. It's actually on the Nintendo Wii, and it's actually a really good third party game on the Wii.
Right, but the question I have is this, and this is whenever I see a celebrity who's done a game, is it his name that someone else did? Because that's probably what it is.
That's a fair question. That's what I asked.
Steven Spielberg does not have the background and training to actually be a game designer.
So here's what Mr. Castle told me, the guy that worked on it, here's what he told me, because I asked him that same question. I'm like, okay, Spielberg didn't come into the office at 7 a.m. and work 12 hours. And he said, no, of course not. He's Spielberg. He doesn't have that time. He would come in once a week for 4 hours, and he would just look at the game, talk to the designers, give his feedback. And a lot of his input is based on ideas, not necessarily – he's not in the code. He's not necessarily going too deep into the level design.
See, that makes sense.
Yeah. so he didn't take he didn't take credit or try to paint himself as something he wasn't.
Credit on the game for being the designer.
Is he? Okay, well, yes. Maybe that's more to sell it than it is. I didn't talk to Spielberg, so I don't know what, what Spielberg said.
Sure. How many times was there a thing that a Wes Craven film, but he was executive producer, which means he did nothing?
Is that what that means?
Yeah, because I was executive producer on the movie The Whisperer in Darkness, and I did nothing.
Really? Okay, I didn't know it was that easy to...
Well, I contributed money.
Okay, well, huh.
And,
interesting.
So I got my name in the credits. So that's how I know what an executive producer does.
Interesting.
I mean, I'm proud to have done it and have my name on the movie. I think it's a good movie, but I also now know what an executive producer does. So
it's these little things.
And he did nothing.
How the sausage is made.
I did have to evaluate the movie and see if I'd be willing to put the money in. So it meant that I'd rate. So I guess that was on me, not the movie, right? Oh, this is a good movie. I'll put money in. So I guess the fact that Wes Craven backed a movie means he thought it was good, but it doesn't mean he did anything on it.
Well, I thought it was interesting that Spielberg even... I mean, I think Spielberg is a big gamer. I think he wanted to... I mean, he didn't work on too many games after that.
Yeah, I've heard that there are other... sounds like, according to the Wikipedia article, which is probably mostly a lie because it's Wikipedia, it says that he wanted a game to play with his grandkids.
Yeah. Which,
you know.
Well, the most interesting part of the conversation was...
like he's unaware of the fact that there's a lot of games you can play with your grandkids right now already.
But he also worked on Medal of Honor, which was many years in the past. Like, he actually worked on the story of Medal of Honor. But, no, I think it's interesting when...
The story sounds like something he could have done. The story is someone else is going to have to make the adventures. And so I actually did that on the Age of Empires 2 campaigns, where I would go and I would say... Actually, and also I did it on the Age of Empires 2 campaigns, the War Chiefs campaign... The Conqueror's campaign, and of course the campaigns in Rise of Rome. I didn't do it on the main campaigns in Age of Empires 1 or the main campaign in Age of Empires 3, which is why it's so wacky. So, but I would go in there and say, okay, we're going to have a scenario about this. And I said, here's the situation. I go to the designers and say, this is the Battle of the Metaurus. So what you do is you're in the middle. There's a bad guys down here and bad guys up here. And you have to rush north and kill these bad guys before the other ones get to you and surround you and kill you. And then I would have them design it however they would design it. But I would give them the basic historical background of the situation. So like the Joan of Arc scenario, I said, here's the battles in sequence. Here's her glorious victories at the end. Here's Montezuma's campaign, you know.
Well, we are, Sandy, at the hour mark. I asked people in Reddit for some questions, so they would burn me at the stake.
Okay, let's answer the questions.
Yeah, let me make sure to please the Reddit crowd as well.
By the way, I got to say right now, I just last week saw a video that said you should never end your speech with a question and answer session.
Really? Well, I didn't get that memo.
Well, you know, I'm not going to change what I do, but the first thing you say and the last thing you say are what they remember. And so if you should have question and answer in the middle, then you end with the last part of your speech so they remember that instead of the Q&A. So
you know what? Maybe I can edit this thing somehow. I don't know. I'll think about it.
I'm just saying, random YouTube guy whose name I can't recall says that you shouldn't end with the Q&A. So you can
take that with a grain of salt. Did he and his team ever consider buildable bridges to cross narrow water sections of maps?
Yes. Absolutely. And the programmers came to us with burning torches and pitchforks and said, this will destroy the pathing. Don't do it.
That's the reason.
And I said, what if the ships can go underneath it? And they said, this will destroy the pathing. Don't do it. Also, if the ships can go underneath it, then sometimes the ships will get mixed up and they'll sail onto the land and go around on the land and do things.
Oh, and I said, so it's a technical thing?
You can stop that. And they said, we could stop that, but we don't want to. For the tiny benefit you get of buildable bridges is not worth all the massive, giant programming stuff we'd have to do to allow it. And we have other things that we'd rather do, like fixing the bug that makes everyone go to coordinates 0, 0 on the map.
All right, so for those developers out there, you can be done. So keep annoying them, and maybe they'll do it, guys. That should not be a problem anymore.
Now, one of the things is they said, now in the system we had then, where computers were not as advanced as now, they said, after you build the bridge, the computer would have to stop and refigure a bunch of pathing stuff. And so the game would pause for like a minute or two while it figured that out. Probably you could get away without that now.
Interesting. Okay, well, developers, if you're listening, get to it. Has he seen the longest game in AOE 2 history? 95 hours.
Of course not.
You haven't seen.
Who would ever?
Not the whole. Who would ever watch the whole game? Have you heard of it? Have you? You don't have to watch the whole game. I can send you a link as well. But yeah, there was a game that was 95 hours.
This is 97 hours, a stalemate.
Yeah. Wow. I disconnected at the end, actually. That's how it ended.
Did they have potty breaks? I mean, isn't this
what they way more than potty breaks?
StarCraft player, isn't that the StarCraft guy in Korea died from doing this, right?
Yeah, the guy in the cafe playing StarCraft. Yeah, that was a sad story.
I can't imagine that they were having, I'll say this, I can't imagine they were still having fun.
They didn't play for 95 hours straight. They took they went on with their lives. They left the games running and straight. It was basically a deadlock because both players had no way to generate gold, and neither of them had a way to attack each other's town centers or castles, whatever was left. And then it just came down to this like micro game where like the only way
was H2.
Yeah, this is H2.
Okay, so they couldn't get gold. They couldn't trade.
They ran out of gold. It was a two-player game. They ran out of gold. They destroyed each other's markets, so they had no relic income. They had no income of any kind. They were both down to like a castle and a town center each. And the only way to win, essentially, what it came down to was some micro when the other player is offline. So one guy would set his alarm to the other guy's like off time zone, like in the middle of the night. And he would wake up and he would try to like micro villagers to attack a castle. It's one of the most ludicrous games I've ever seen in my life. And then essentially the guy...
I guess the woods were all chopped down so they couldn't farm, huh?
No, nothing. There was no way to generate any kind of resource at that point. It's a crazy game. I mean, if you're looking for a video idea, I'm going to give you that one. React to, T90's video.
And I thought the Black Forest games were nuts.
Do you know The Legend of Fat Slob?
No, I
no.
remember. I always refused to play Black Forest back in the day, though. I said this is only for you guys that suck. We'll put it in the game, but I'm not going to try to balance it or anything. It's dumb.
So Fat Slob is a user that has been playing Black Forest in a certain. I think it's like version 1.2 something. It's a specific version that basically does not allow you to chop wood with mangonels or trebuchets. So he's played over like 10,000 games of Black Forest, and he only plays Vikings, and it only plays when both civs are Vikings. And what he does is essentially builds a wall in the middle at the start, and he builds like 30 layers of the wall, and then he creates a death ball, a Viking death ball, and like it's it's not unbeatable, obviously, but he's found a way to win a decent percentage using this identical strategy on this identical map 1,000 times.
Well, I mean, if you get really good at one specific setup, then obviously you'll be better than any other player is at that, right?
Sure, to a certain extent.
Anything, I'm going to be really good on the islands map using.
It needs to be a map with very little variation. That's the key, though. That needs to be very little variation.
Well, islands probably wouldn't work.
Black Forest wouldn't work.
That's why Black Forest was so boring, right? Because it didn't have any variation.
But this guy is a legend. If you ever look up Fat Slob into YouTube, you think you're going to be blown away that this is a real thing. He played the Viper one time, and the game disconnected. And he was basically saying, like, Viper is like, hey, can we just continue where the game left off because I have a save file? And Fat Slob was losing that game, and he's like, yeah, no, I was like, I'm not going to continue. Like, I'm not going to start a new game. Or, no, he was like, I want to start a new game because, I was winning or whatever. I don't know. He made up some excuse. But point being, he tried to pot off a win against the best player in the world.
So he wanted to pull up his pants and go home.
Correct. He was playing the best player like of all time, and he was going to lose. And then the game disconnected.
Yeah, because Viper is a legend, you know?
Yeah. There's a lot of funny videos on like, this is what I mean. There's so much fun AOE content if you ever go down that route. Let me see if I've got more questions. Infantry.
So the Viper, infantry, what about
it? Go ahead. Oh, you had a question about the Viper. Go ahead.
No. The Viper plays other civs, though. He's
Yeah. But he played him. He played him in his rules in his Black Forest, right. And he was beating
him. He probably then he would have won.
100%. I mean, I don't think anyone's debating that,
but
except
also,
him.
Notice that the Viper, that one of the things I do remember about him from something I saw maybe on a YouTube video is that he'll do weird strategies. So that I respect. He's not repeating the same thing again and again. He'll try out things. And I'm sure he tries strategies that then fail.
Of course.
Just because if you do a lot of weird things, some of them are going to fail, right?
I mean, these guys are on another level.
That shows he's got heart, you know?
But these guys are, like, we're talking about, like, Viper is, like, the best of all time, arguably. So he's got a point where he can experiment.
I'm sure that Viper playing a terrible strategy will still beat Right, but still, you know, when he's playing the top guys and he picks a wacko strategy and he loses, I mean, you suck it up, right? But I respect the Viper.
The Viper,
the fast guy. I'm like, I guess I kind of want to sit back and admire him from a distance, but I don't think I'd want to hang with him.
Really?
You know, I wouldn't mind hanging out with the Viper. You know? Well, he's like he'd only have one thing he'd ever talk about.
Right. Well. Right.
You know, he's got a bee in his bonnet about something. It's like when I'm talking to a guy who's upset about some ballot. Like, there's this one guy that constantly he stopped lately, but he used to go into all my comment things and accuse me of ruining Age of Empires 1 because I introduced chariots.
Oh my God, let it go, my guy. It's been 30 years. What are you doing?
He's so mad. So I actually sort of called him out. I didn't give his name, but I said, this guy annoys me because he, right? And I said, but my response to him when he says, you ruined Age of Empires by introducing the chariot. And I said, oh, too bad. That's why it sold so poorly, I guess, you know, and just like blew it off. But so I wouldn't want to sit down for dinner with that guy because he just go on and on about how the chariots ruined the game.
I understand that where you're coming from.
Viper, you know, I think it'd be fun. I think it'd be fun to talk to, except that he, I guess, is Norwegian. So.
Viper, if you're in Madrid next month,
all the Norwegians I've spoken with spoke perfect English. Maybe that's because the only Norwegians that would talk to me were already speaking.
No, English, he speaks perfect English. Another question.
They all learned it in school, right?
Of course.
Like, well, Germans are the same way. I was once in a car ride with a German, and he started off. We were talking, and we talked for like half an hour. He's driving me somewhere. And then he said, I'm so sorry. My English is super bad. I can barely do it. I said, dude, we just had a conversation.
Right. You're fluent.
You know, I wish my German was that bad, you know?
Right.
But
they do that a lot. Germans do that a lot, I've noticed as well. Oh, I'm sorry. I don't speak English. But like, it's literally fluent. Like, it's perfect.
But they literally speak English. Yeah. Whereas the Japanese don't speak English and they don't speak English. You know, the Japanese are terrible. I think it's because the Japanese educational system is memorization largely, which is not a good way to learn a language.
Yeah, no, it's not. No.
Okay, sorry. Go on to the next question.
Next question. What are his thoughts on how infantry is regarded in the game? Where archer knight rushes seem to be a common strategy, how little swordsmen are used, and what might he propose to change that in the game to make it more popular?
Well, in Age 2, the basic rock, paper, scissors was always that infantry would defeat cavalry, cavalry would defeat archers, and archers would defeat infantry. Infantry are the weak sister in this thing because cavalry have the extra advantage beyond the combat thing is that they're fat, so you can get them somewhere quick, okay? Archers have the extra advantage that they're ranged. Infantry have nothing going for them except that they can beat cavalry. You know, so I would say that the infantry are clearly going to not, and also because Age of Empire is really a lot about raiding, not so much about the mass battles. Most of the fights are really more like skirmishes, you know, and historically infantry, we were good in these mass battles. I think if you want to make infantry better, I think the correct way to do it is not to increase their stats, because I think their stats are fine. I think it's to make them cheaper.
Cheaper, interesting. So they become like Zerglings in StarCraft. They become disposable plentiful.
Yes, which is kind of historically what the infantry were, right? They're cheaper to train. It took years, you know, it took like 10 years to get a longbowman.
Right.
That's why they went out of business. Not because they weren't better than guns and crossbows, but because it took so long to train. So if you had a fight and you lost some long, right? For example, the Turks at the Battle of Lepanto, they lost the sea battle and they had 30,000 longbowmen on those boats who all drowned. Next year, they had all the ships back, but they couldn't replace those archers. They were actually composite boats, not long. same thing, right? And so you, so because it takes years and years to train an archer, but you can give a guy a spear and say, go in there and fight, and he's good to go in a week or two.
Fascinating.
Right? Like, even a horse is expensive because you don't have to train a guy to ride a horse because you only pick guys who already ride horses, right? But the horse is expensive. The horse costs as much to take care of as a man, but twice the cost. They're harder to ship. You know, you can't put them aboard your boats as easy to take up three times their space as a man.
So horses are expensive. War. Yeah, the logistics of war. Never really thought about these things.
And guns won because they were cheap to make, and they were easy. It was cheaper to make a gun than a crossbow.
Yeah, that makes sense. I never thought about it.
Mechanical parts and swivels and tensions, and a gun is a tube with a hole in the end and some fire. It's really cheap. It's really easy to use a gun. You just point it and fire it, and then it has its effect. It's pretty effective if it hits. Of course, it often misses because, like, early guns sucked. But so guns won because of cheapness. Similarly, bronze armor was actually better than iron armor
because it was more efficient to produce
but iron armor, the thing is, once you learn how to smelt iron is harder to smelt because you just take bronze, you mix tin and copper together, right? With iron, you have to learn how to smelt iron ore. But once you learn how to smelt iron ore is everywhere, so iron was cheap. And so the difference was, your bronze army had 10% of their guys armored in bronze, okay, which is almost a precious metal because it's got copper in it. And my iron army is like 60% in armor. It's not as good as your 10% guys, but I have a lot more guys in armor. So iron is better. And of course, later on when they got steel, that was actually better than bronze, but that was much later. So
it's a numbers game. Everything seems like a numbers game.
Absolutely a numbers game.
I always wondered you had more. Sorry.
So if you want to make infantry better comparison, you do it making it cheaper.
Gotcha. All right, one more, and then I got to get going.
Specifically about the early Archer Knight rush, what I would do is I would make them cheaper in that age.
You would make infantry cheaper in that age to protect against a knight archer rush?
No. To make it, look, how cheap would infantry have to be before you'd use it instead of archers and knights?
Oh, I see what you're saying. Okay, right. I gotcha. All right, well,
there's some level where you'd rather send in the infantry, right?
Yeah, you have to find that balancing act, right?
Maybe one way of doing it without totally destroying the balance would be saying that the first 20 infantry you make are free. And after that, they cost the normal amount.
Right. So, yeah. Mm-hmm. Interesting.
That's the thing I would try if I was still balancing the game, if I wanted to make infantry better.
Well, infantry has not been well balanced for years.
Make that first 20 infantry, because that's good. And then every attack, once you've already got infantry and you've started buying infantry upgrades, then you're kind of caught in the trap of, I have to keep making infantry.
Yeah, I understand. All right, last question. I got to get going, unfortunately. So I always wondered if mechanics like optimized build orders, pushing deers, luring boars, laming were intendedly designed advanced mechanics.
They were not designed in advanced mechanics. What happened is our goal was to make a realistic, interesting world and then saw what stuff came from that. But all those things are basic enough that even we at Ensemble Studios figured them out.
You figured out luring boars and pushing deer, stuff like that?
Yeah, well, not everything that people do nowadays, but we stole each other's sheep, that kind of thing. And we'd lure boars. So we worked that out, but we didn't go in doing that. We went in there initially just saying, hey, let's have a wild boar that gives you a lot of food, but he's dangerous. You can't get him right at the start.
Risk reward, right.
Yeah, right. And then we said, let's give everyone a scout so they can scout the map. Well, we didn't initially think that the scout would be stealing sheep, but of course he does, right? So then that was kind of cool. We didn't take that out. We just said, okay, they will balance it knowing that this is there. So basically one of the approaches we had, and it's not the same as every design group, is that when we saw some kind of emergent or interesting trick or technique, like we didn't clamp down on it and try to stop it. We said, hey, cool.
Let it flourish.
Let's see what we can do with it.
Right.
What can we do with that? A lot of designers are more anal retentive. Not all of them, but there's some that are like, oh no, this is what I intended, and they'll try to stop it. They only want what they want in the game. But we were happy to have people try different things. So, like, for example, we never dreamed that people would be using mangonels to cut down forests. We just put that in there.
But that added such a, that added another layer to the game, just unintentionally.
It was originally an accident.
And that you didn't want to nerf it. You didn't want to nerf it when you saw it happen?
We didn't know it was there. We said, people said, hey, I have a problem with my mangonels. When I target someone, they never hit because they will go away first. And we said, what I want to do is be able to target the ground. And then I can aim where I think they're going to go and it will hit them. We said, that's a cool ability. So we programmed it in. What we didn't realize is that if you're targeting the ground, it changes what you're able to hit with your shells.
Wow. That's cool.
You can hit trees.
Yeah.
And then when it took us like a month to realize that we were able to cut down forests. And then we said, hey, let's keep it in. That's cool. You know, I really like keeping it because it messed up those damn Black Forest maps.
I mean, there's a new mode that's like 256x where you start off. It's like the entire map is a wood, and then you have to chop your way out. But like you can stack upgrades, so you can have like the lumber upgrade like 200 times. So like you chop wood really quick.
Let me tell you about this awesome secret. Originally, for a very brief moment, the mangonels could destroy stone and gold too.
Really. That would be broken.
That went away fast.
Yeah, I was going to say, that would be broken.
Yeah, that was one game, and we said, okay, not going in. Like, that is not a feature. So we did clamp down on that. We didn't let every feature exist because that'd be
game-breaking. Sandy, thank you so much for your time. We could do this every day for 10 hours.
Oh,
I still, I really send me a link or send me more information. I'd love to come to Madrid. It's a 2-hour train ride for me.
Sure. So Hinter.
Send me whatever information. We'll organize something. I'll give you my number here in Spain.
Madrid is the convention.
Perfect. Awesome. For people that are interested, I'm leaving a bunch of links down below to all the things Sandy's working on, his website, his content. Please check it out.
Sandy of Cthulhu is my YouTube channel.
Perfect.
And there are some things in the past about Age of Empire on it.
Awesome. More of that, I hope, for the hardcore fanatics.
PetersonGames.com is my company. It's currently undergoing some modifications, so you may go on there and say, oh, this is evil and broken, but I promise it won't be broken forever.
Beautiful. I have no doubt you're going to be on top of it. Thank you so much for your time. I'm always grateful to talk to you.